We are now recording.
I call the Tuesday, November 17th, 2020 Legislation and Rules Committee meeting to order. Can I have a roll call, please?
Leroy Brady. Did you unmute yourself, Leroy?
It was unmuted.
That's right. I'm here.
Jason Foose?
Here.
Robert Stanley?
Here.
Edward Marley?
Here.
Peter Leeds?
Present.
We have a quorum.
All right. Thank you. Call to the public. Pursuant to ARS 38431.01H, the committee members are not allowed to discuss or take action on matters raised during an open call to the public unless the matters are properly noticed for discussion and action. However, members may ask staff to review a matter or may ask that a matter be placed on a future agenda. Is anyone present who would like to speak on an item that is not currently on the agenda?
I did not receive any notice whatsoever from anyone regarding a call to the public.
Okay, great. Then we will move on to adoption of minutes. Approve, modify, and or reject March 12th, 2019 L&R committee minutes. Can I have a motion, please?
And Mr. Chairman,
I move. I'll move that we accept the minutes.
Do I have a second?
I'll second that, Peter Leeds.
Any discussion? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote. All those in favor, say aye.
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 If I can say, with these remote meetings, it might be preferable to do a roll call vote for each thing.
Okay, so we'll do a roll call vote.
Okay. Leroy Brady.
Aye.
Jason Foose.
Aye.
Robert Stanley. Robert Stanley is muted. Unmute yourself, Rob.
Hate these things. Aye. Sorry about that.
Hey, Rob. How are you?
Good to see
you. Okay. Edward Murray.
Not too bad.
Aye.
Peter Leeds.
Aye.
All right. Motion carried.
All right, further discussion and possible action. We'll down the list here.
And Mr. Marley, I've also provided you with the call-in list, just so you have an idea of who is here for specific items and who is not.
Okay, so, and these folks who have submitted questions are the ones that, are they on the call now, or
so,
do you need to call them?
They are all on the call now. John King had declined the meeting invite. He was 5A, so I don't believe he's on the call at all. So,
okay.
Mr. Kesty is on the line. If I look at our list here, so that's 5B.
I'd like to jump to 5. I'd like to cover the ones who are on the line so that if they choose to drop off afterwards, they certainly can, given the flexibility.
Okay.
And if they want to stay on, that's great too.
I would say that then 5B. The individual is online for that, and that'd be the first in line.
Okay, so let's move to, we'll pass over agenda item A temporarily. We'll move to agenda item 5B. Are private easements a pertinence that must be shown on final plats and dedications? So, Mr. Kesty, I believe you presented that this question to our group, and what I'd like to do is let you say a few words about it. If you can start your presentation with your name, please, for the record.
Thank you. This is Keith Kesty, engineering supervisor with the City of Phoenix. Good morning, everyone. Appreciate you giving me a couple of minutes and also your attention to this matter, as we do a lot of flats here in the City of Phoenix. I've been with the City of Phoenix for about 4 years, and during that time, we have asked developers to not add any private easements on our flats. And our thought process at that time was that we don't need to show private easements on flats, as they are not germane to our platting process. We to those, and they're not dedicated to the public, nor do we map them in our GIS mapping system, which is basically our repository for all public easements. And also, we were concerned that our plat process would be turning into an ALTA survey. The development community, both the professional surveyors and the developers, asked us to reconsider our position. And the basis of their request was that plats are used as part of the public report, and the people who are buying parcels of land, particularly lots and subdivisions, rely on the plat to show all elements that may affect their property or affect their HOA management of common property. And so we pushed back and said, no, we don't want to do that. And they said, well, could we consider asking the Board of Technical Registration? So I had sent an email about a year ago and received feedback from staff pointing out that we need to consider these as appurtenances. And for myself personally, it's the first time I had considered it. And since that time, we've changed our process to allow private easements to be shown on plaques as long as they have a recording number. And we have two notes on there pointing out that we don't review them and we don't need to be part of the abandonment process of private easements unless we have a vested interest in them. So that's just a brief overview. So if you have any questions, feel free.
Does anyone have questions? Mr. Foose, you're our subject matter expert on this. So I think we're going to be leaning heavily on you today.
I'm having trouble hearing Ed. Ed, could you repeat that?
I'm sorry. Mr. Foose, I was just saying that it's probably best for you're probably our subject matter expert on this for today, so we're going to lean on you to get your insights and thoughts on this question.
Thank you. I think the city of Phoenix has come to a realization in the comments that were made earlier as they realized from their feedback from the profession is that this matter's out of their authority. A subdivision plat is an owner's report to the public of the conditions of the property that potential grantees may purchase or acquire. The city has a little bit of authority with the dedications and concerns for the dedications as they would be the fiduciary of those rights. But the rest of the plat, the city really has nothing to do with. Now, I understand that they process it and they review it, and I do the same thing here at Mojave County. I represent the county in that same way. But the authority of the reviewing agency only goes that far as just reviewing. So if there's a factual condition that exists, the owner's obligated to put that on the plat for the benefit of the purchasers. So the city is really overstepping their bounds when they tell somebody to place or not place something like this on a plat. And that leads up to ARS 32-130, the review of drawings, plans, or design specifications by public agencies. I don't want to get too far down that road, but if the city feels they need to alter the owner's presentation of what is factual, then the city's obligated to sign it, get the appropriate registrant to sign it. So it's a poor practice. I know it probably doesn't fit the city's model, business model, or they have some other concern, and I understand and appreciate that. As the city representative said, they don't need it for their purposes. Well, this plat is bigger than their purposes. There's much more to this than just the city's approvals. So, with that, I don't want to kick this dead horse, but I think the city, it would be in the best interest of the city and the health, safety, and welfare of the public if the city adopted or retracted rather, their policy of coercing people not to show factual information.
This is Keith. Thank you for that clarification. You're right about one thing, in that, you know, sometimes we have processes here at municipalities that have quite a long life to them, and sometimes we forget why the decision was made. So it's always good to look at these things again, even though it may feel like it's kicking a dead horse for you. There's a high turnover of people here, and we appreciate your patience and helping us remember what we're supposed to. One thing that I'd like to get clarified is how, of those items that are of interest to the owner if they represent their property to prospective buyers, what about the ALTA survey? I mean, one option on that is, let's say, topographic mapping. Are you suggesting that all items on an ALTA survey, if the owner wants to show them, are appropriate?
I don't know if I can answer that question directly. What I can say is the plat is done under the authority of the owner, and it's reviewed by the city or municipality, and the municipality has some authority for the rights of way that are they're granted, or public rights, easements and things like that. So private easements, although you're not going to accept them, they're outside of your authority anyways. So they are the between the owner and the seller would be one way to look at it. Now, agencies have mapping standards. The state statutes are very weak on mapping standards. And adopted practices, if they go through a process and the municipality follows that process and they report these things in their subdivision regulations, so everybody's on the level playing field that knows all these rules and what they're supposed to show and what they're not supposed to show under the authority of the city's regulatory business, then it's up to the city to define that. But for the city to bar factual information on a plat is not a good practice at all. In fact, I'd say it's contrary to law. Whether they like it or not, it's a fact that it exists. Survey maps are records of things that have happened. They're factual records. They're reports. They're not like engineering plans that are somewhat of a proposal or a schematic of how things are supposed to be. These things are reports of what happened on the ground. So that's the way the courts look at them, and that's the importance of maintaining the integrity of whatever the owner feels obligated to put on there as part of this larger real estate transaction that's going to happen.
Okay, Jason, you said a couple of things, and it brings a couple of questions to my mind. You said that the law is, the legislation we have in relation to some of this is a little bit weak. Another question I have, this can't be just a situation with the city of Phoenix. What about other communities throughout the state? And the other thing, last question I've got, since it's not covered extensively by law, or definitely, is this an area that we could help ourselves by having a substantive policy statement?
I don't think we need to do that. I don't think that the board has to do it. I think that the city needs to examine what their focus is. Now, if the city development services department or zoning division or whoever the authority is there, if they go through the process and they spell out, we don't want to show private easements, or we don't want you to show private easements, and they run this through the public meetings and changing their subdivision regulations and all that, their attorneys are going to look at it and say, okay, that's good or that's bad. Right? So theoretically, there's protection there, and everybody's aware of this. The public would be completely aware that in the city of Phoenix, you may or may not get, or in this case, would not get the benefit of having private easements shown on this plat. I still, personally, I think that's beyond their authority, but at least it goes through some kind of public notice. Title companies would roll over at that. They would absolutely detest that. The surveyors, I believe, would be in the same boat. And it is generally harmful to not show a pertinent information on a plat. Factual information, by the way. I mean, these are things that happen. So I think the city ultimately, and kind of in a more relaxed way, is doing a disservice to the public by not showing these things.
So I'm going to interject here a little bit. This is Ed. It sounds to me like, Mr. Kesty, that the city of, sorry, these masks to make it a little hard to. I got some right here. Okay. But it sounds to me like the city of Phoenix has already altered their requirements to allow the showing of these easements on your plats, and even just requiring a note that says that it's not, that they have not been reviewed by City of Phoenix staff, which to me sounds like the problem solved. I guess the question is, are there other jurisdictions that have similar requirements that perhaps rather than a substantive policy statement, do we want to just send out a letter from the board saying to municipalities saying you can't, not that you can't do this, but this is not good practice, it's not in alignment with the survey standards of the state or something along that, you know, whoever are, I think maybe Jason, if you're still our illustrious chair, you know, you can crap something and go out under your signature, but it just seems to me something
I don't think that's necessary at all. Okay. I think that the municipalities and the counties too, and I'm a county surveyor, I review maps, so I'm in the same boat as Keith here.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to speak from the other side of the fence, I guess, but the point is, that's really outside of our authority. We're not concerned with private easements, but if somebody shows that, they make that presentation on a plat, because it's outside of my authority, I really can't say take it off. You know, I mean, I don't know if I'm expressing that correctly, but it's just plain outside of the regulatory authority.
Okay.
So, our regulatory authority. So, again, if a municipality under their subdivision authority adopted rules that said we don't do this, and it stands the test of all of their lawyers and everybody else that's going to look at it, well, that's something different. But to have just an internal administrative policy that says you don't show this on a plat, it's very harmful to the public, actually.
I guess that's my concern, is if they're having a requirement. If I look at a plat from the city of Phoenix as a potential investor in a property, and I take it at face value, and it hasn't, and it's an older one, and it hasn't shown these private easements, you know, if I'm not the most savvy investor, I may not know where to look or even be aware that they exist until you get the title. And did it show up in the title report?
Well, we're not going to fix history. That's the sad part of Arizona. We can't fix all these mistakes that happened that are of record. Okay. We just have to live with them the best we can.
Right. No, and I'm not trying to revise. I'm not trying to fix history. What I'm saying is, going forward, how do we best protect the public health, safety, and welfare in this, so that we don't have plats out there that don't have easements on them that actually exist?
Well, the city simply doesn't comment on it. I mean, it's outside of their authority.
Okay.
Or that's my personal opinion. It's outside of their authority. Don't comment on it. Just leave them on there. People will put them on there. The registrants feel the obligation to show these items on the maps because the owners feel the obligation to show them on the maps under disclosure, which, you know, that's a whole separate ball of wax than land surveying or platting or the municipal regulation of subdivisions. That's something that deals with a landowner selling land in Arizona. So that's a whole different thing that's, you know, really outside of my reach, but I know it's there. So that, I think, is the importance. Just don't say anything as the regulatory agency. Let the people do what they feel they need to do. Now, I say that with a couple of caveats. I mean, you don't want to let them do everything. I mean, there are subdivision regulations, and I'm sure Phoenix has local mapping standards and things like that that have been adopted through the public process, which we don't want to upset that either. But I think Keith really hit the nail on the head when he said that the city of Phoenix doesn't need them. Well, this action and that item or those types of items on a plat don't have anything to do with the city of Phoenix, but they have everything to do with the buyer and seller. So that's why I think the city may not feel the importance, because it's not in their direct regulatory purview.
Hi, this is Peter.
Hi, Peter.
Can someone add a comment or talk a little bit about this subject from one of the other participants?
I'd love to hear from anybody on it.
Absolutely.
Okay, Matt. This is Peter Vizeki. I'm a registered surveyor, registered civil engineer, and I've been listening to this, and I was unaware that this obviously going on. We're in our private practice. We're not recognizing these elements. But my point is, I think, in my opinion, that some kind of a letter from the board actually would be good, because I'm under the assumption that we can't put private easements on plats. And if you can, that I agree. That's what anything that has happened and is of record should be on there, because they don't necessarily go to the ALTA. They're typically going to a plat. And those are items of record. They should be on there. So if I go to the city of Mesa or I go to city of Scottsdale, you know, they may have the same regulation. And if they don't know about this, you're going to go through the same process if the surveyor wants to put that information on there, or the owner, as you suggested. So I think it's good to get this out, this kind of information out, so it gives a guide to surveyors to produce these plats, knowing that, yes, they can put them on, because I just assumed that you couldn't because we've not been allowed to. I think it makes sense to do it. I agree with that, but I think without providing that information, I don't think everybody's going to know. All the registrants aren't going to know, and certainly the communities aren't going to know about this. I don't think everybody's in tune with what's going on here, and so that my recommendation would be to provide some kind of information to the engineers and to the municipalities, counties, some way.
Well, thank you for those comments, and I'm reluctant to offer anything formally for this reason. If a municipality or a county has adopted something through the process, I don't want to undermine their process of going through whatever their city council or their board of supervisors. You know, when they go through the full public process and adopt their subdivision regulations, I don't want to undermine that. So if it's in their subdivision regulations, and that's what the public has accepted in that community, I don't want to go down that road. If there are administrative practices that have been developed over time for the ease of administrative processing, those are the things we want to address. So let me kick the ball back on the registrant and say, first of all, read the local regulations where you're at. Don't just assume what they are. Get that subdivision regulation book, do your job, read through all those regs, understand what you're submitting and what the city requirements are. If there's a snag in those city requirements, then that might rise to the level of coming back to the board and getting some official opinion at that time.
But
administrative countertop, well, we don't like this, then those things should be addressed at the counter.
Well, the problem with that is when you're doing a plat, you have to get it done in a reasonable amount of time. If you have to bring it to the level of the board, again, I mean, you're talking about, I put my item on here over 4 months ago, and it's just now being looked at. So, I mean, if you don't have something out there, how are you going to know? You're going to read the regulations. I get what your point is. Read the regulations. Know what you've got to do. I know what we've got to do. But I've never seen something that says, I've never been in a situation where we would have been allowed to put private easement information on plats. Just never seen it. So maybe other people have been doing it. I've been doing surveying for 40 years.
Has it all been in Arizona?
Yep.
I feel some abrasion with the term allowed to put something on the plat. When I hear that, the hair on the back of my neck stands up, because I'm the person reporting on that plat as a surveyor, right? So you're going to take my report and do what you need to do with it as the regulatory agency. So when I hear those kind of things, I start to think, well, who's the authority here? You know, and that's a bigger question for our registrants to start asking. So that's where I say go back to the subdivision regulations, look at them. You know, maybe you want to do that before you bid a job in a certain city. You know, I hate to say that sounds elementary and very insensitive, but again, you know, you pose the question of, well, you know, we don't have time because we're doing this plat, we're doing this and that. Well, if your professional level of practice is just cram it through however we can get it through, then you're going to suffer things like
that. Man, oh man. I'm done. I'm sorry. I don't know. I feel like I'm being attacked here. Like, I don't do my job. I've been on the Enforcement Advisory Committee for the Technical Board of Registration since 1996. I think I know that element of it. So I'm simply indicating that not everybody knows. And I think it would be a good practice if nobody else thinks that's the case. I'm done.
Okay. Well, I don't mean to offend you, sir, and I notoriously speak loud and direct, and that's a character flaw that I have, so please don't take that as please don't misinterpret that to be telling or anything. But I don't mean to offend you here, but there are certain things that the registrant is responsible for. So that's where I end up with this. I will say that anything you've heard over the last 5 minutes or 10 minutes since I started speaking is not authoritative from the board. It's personal opinion. I'll hold on to that personal opinion. And again, my apologies if I've offended you.
Mr. Chairman, this is Peter Lee. Can I interject here?
Yes, please.
It seems to me that a letter would be appropriate if, in fact, or maybe even a substantive policy statement would be appropriate, even if we had to go through the trouble of saying everything that you just said. Do your research and realize that whatever information is necessary to go on the plat to help the rights of ownership of the real property, then you should be able to put it on. And maybe a letter like that actually goes beyond just saying you can do this, but also telling you that you need to do your research would be advantageous. Peter out.
Thank you, Peter. Yeah, I think we've lost sight of the original topic, and that was the city of Phoenix used to require that if a surveyor submitted a plat and it had private easements on it, they were requiring, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Kesky, they were requiring that if that document was submitted, that easement be taken off of that plat. And I think the problem I'm seeing that we could be faced with is, and this is why we have one of our substantive policy statements about plan review comments, is we have a registered design professional who is putting information on a document, professional document that they seal that they feel is important to that document, and they're having a jurisdiction require that they remove that information. And I think that's where the disconnect is right now. And so I think, I don't see it as surveyors necessarily not doing what they're supposed to do. I see them being forced into a corner that you don't get your plat approved if you don't take this information off. And I think City of Phoenix has fixed that problem based on what I've heard, but that doesn't mean there aren't other jurisdictions out there doing the same thing and putting registrants in a bind. And so that's why I'm leaning toward issuing some kind of a letter to municipalities that just says, if a design professional feels something needs to be on a document, it needs to stay there. And if you want to do a clarifying note that says, we haven't reviewed this information, that's fine. But I think the discretion always needs to fall with the design professional.
This is Keith. I really appreciate all the comments that have been made. It does help me manage our processes here at City of Phoenix. This request to remove the private easements, as was pointed out, once I looked at that, it was administrative. I had looked into our subdivision ordinance, which manages our mapping standards, and there was no comment on private easements. So it was administrative, and the professional engineers had a right to push back on us as a municipality and ask us under what authority do we have to say remove it, and we did it. And once the Board of Technical Registration helped us understand what the situation was, we were more than willing to change. We just didn't understand. And to the point about other mapping standards, now that I've had some further clarification on how to review our ordinances, and if we feel strongly about something, use that public process, which includes both the public, the city council, legal counsel, and go down that route so our community knows exactly what they're getting into. So this has been a huge help for me, this discussion.
Thank you, Keith. I do that every day here at the county. I mean, I look at my regulations, and I'm saying this one's weak, this one's bad, this one is misaligned or irrelevant or whatever. So I'm doing it on the other side, too, on your side, where we're saying, hey, we need to make a change in our process, and here's how the process is spelled out. So try to avoid those whimsical administrative preferences.
So I think the issue brought up by the City of Phoenix is they've resolved, it's kind of self-resolved. I guess the discussion really is, do we want to forward a request to the board that a letter go out to municipalities? And if so, I would entertain a motion. And if not...
May I add something to the...
Yes, please.
No. I think... Well, I guess it should also be identified in the publications the board puts out to the registrants as well. So I think that should be not just to the, I think the not only should the municipalities have that, I think it would be good for the registrant, the community of surveyors to have that as well.
Okay. We can always put it on our website.
Yeah, we can put it on the website, we can put it in the newsletter.
And that.
Right, newsletter. Yeah.
That'd be great.
That's a good idea.
That would be great.
Get word out a little further. Yeah. That way the surveying community understands. That is if I get such motion.
Right.
Anyone interested in offering up such a motion? If not, well, I guess we'll
move. Yeah, I'll move that we put a clarification for this on the website and then publish it in the next newsletter and ask the board if that would be okay.
And also, should we also include in that sending the letter directly to municipalities for their clarification?
Sounds good.
Okay. Do I have a second?
I'll second. This is Leroy.
Any further discussion?
This is Peter Leach. I'm interested in what would be in that letter and what would be in that the newsletter itself. Other than the fact that it is the proper procedure to put these easements on plats, but also I was interested in Mr. Fulton's comments about doing your local research. I'd like to know how that letter is going to be written. Peter out.
It's quite preliminary. So yeah. I'm sure that the board would probably read a letter and then, you know, decide if they want that letter or to
right. what staff can do is concisely draft the letter based on the comments that all the committee members made today and provide it to the board in a packet at the next available meeting for their consideration, and they can edit it or add things if they wish at that time.
Thank you.
Any other comments?
Well, I just have a couple of things I'd like to add to that packet then. This is Jason Foose. One of the concerns that I see with issuing a letter like this is if there is already an adopted practice, and I mean legally adopted through process with a municipality or a county, if that exists, we want to be sensitive to whatever language they might have. And we don't want to be abrasive with that, certainly, because if they've
right.
formally adopted a practice, I don't know where that puts us as far as saying you can do this or you can't do that.
Well, their practices have to be more restrictive than our regulations. If they're less restrictive, then they have a problem. Or we have a problem.
Yeah. All right.
Any other comments? Otherwise, I'll call the question. All those in favor, do a roll call, please.
All right. Leroy Brady?
Aye.
Jason Foose?
Aye.
Robert Stanley?
Aye.
Edward Marley?
Aye.
Peter Leeds?
Aye.
Motion carried.
Thank you, gentlemen. And Mr. Kessie, thank you so much for your presentation. We appreciate it. We'll move on to... agenda item 5D, I believe we have Mr. Peter Vasecki on the line. Question from the public, do plan and profile drawings for private sewage lines require field observations prior to sealing? If you could identify yourself, give us your name, please.
Sure, my name is Peter Vasecki. I'm principal of Vespro Engineering, here in working in the since about 1980 in the early 80s, and this did you need anything more from me? I have some questions about the way this question is represented in the agenda.
I think if you could restate your question in your own words, that's perfectly acceptable. We tried to capture it as best we could, but if you would restate it, and then that'll help facilitate our discussion.
Sure. So, there is a revised statute that came out. It's section 32-52. Now, I sent this to the board 3 or 4 times, and it's not represented in this, but what it does say is when the engineer certifies plans that in regard to the certification required, and in this particular item, it talks about sewage lines, but we're not just talking about sewage lines, we're talking about water lines. And when a sewer line, water line goes in, and an engineer designs it, there's a process to get a notice from the municipality of Mojave County, in the county system, to get approval to construct. So you get that permit, approval to construct, and then to close out the project after it's completed, there's an approval of construction. In that approval of construction, the engineer is required to certify the construction. And when I look at that, I'm looking at not just certifying as-builts, in other words, the location of the water line, the sewer line, but the engineer has designed, the bedding, the thrust blocking, all the different elements that are design related, not just the survey information. So if you get an as-built set of plans, and it's just survey information, my practice has been to go out and do construction observation during the installation to ensure that everything has been constructed as designed. And I wouldn't sign a certificate of completion, engineer certificate of completion, without having that information either obtained by myself or bona fide employee. So we're talking about domestic water lines. And I think this strikes to the engineer's responsibility for maintaining the public health, safety, and welfare. So this regulation has come out and basically says that an engineer is required to, if they've not been out during the construction observation period, they're required to sign the as-built and turn it in to get this approval of construction. And I'm at odds with that. I think that we're not complying with the requirement to look out for the public's health, safety, and welfare. Now, sewer lines are one thing. There could be issues with leaks of sewers and so forth. So for my whole practice, I haven't certified anything that I haven't, of any of these documents that I haven't personally witnessed or know that it's gone in and not rely strictly on as-built measurements. Now, what this regulation does is it says, if I'll read right from the ARS section 32-152, if a registered or certified professional did not provide construction phase services on the project that included supervision of construction of the engineering structures, plans shall be based on the information received from the project owner, the project contractor, public agencies, but need not be based on field verification or investigation of the improvements or grades unless the registered surveyor is engaged to provide the field verification. And yet, that's probably not the one I've had. The other one is, if the registered or certified, let's see, the first element of it, I wish you had this document up. Oh, you do have it.
It's up. Yeah.
So the first element, if a person or firm that is registered, certified by the board is required to provide record documents for improvements of grading and plans that show changes during the construction, the following shall apply. So it says improvements or grading. So that, in my opinion, is all improvements, including water and sewer lines and so forth. And that's the ones I'm particularly looking at. There are some elements of grading that, you know, could cause issues with the public as well. If a registered certified professional provided construction phase services on a project that includes supervision of the construction, meaning the plan shall be based on field observation of the registered and certified professional or the professional's agents, information received from the owner, project contractor, or public agency. Or the professional's agents and information provided by the owner. Then the second one, if the registered or certified professional did not provide construction phase services on the project that includes supervision, correction, engineering, the plan should be based on information received from the project owner, project contractors, public agencies, but need not be field verified or investigated the improvements or grades unless the registrant is engaged in providing such services. So that puts the registrant in the position to certify a set of drawings based on simply not including their direct observation of the improvements going in. And I'm very surprised at this because I think that it doesn't protect the public. I personally will not take on a project that doesn't have construction observation, even though this shows this. And I brought this to one of my colleagues, Hal Marin, and I think that his experience on this particular item is beneficial for the board to hear, or this committee to hear. And I think he can interject and help on the call as well. And I'm inviting him to add his perspective on this particular item.
Yes, this became I'm Hal Marin. I'm the town engineer and public works director for the town of Cave Creek, Arizona. And we had this occur about a year ago, where we had a contractor, a design set of plans for what was going to become a public sewer line. And the engineer of record, we got the as-builts in, we were getting ready to accept it, and found that wasn't even constructed according to plan. So I sent off emails and started engaging the design professional. And next thing I know, they're lawyering up using this document and saying that we didn't have the right to, they'd gone outside the easement with the construction. They didn't have any temporary construction easements. And they're using the state law against us in trying to get it. So basically, I told them that until they were able to give me a set of as-builts that I could use, that would be sufficient, that they that we were not going to accept the sewer line, and therefore they couldn't get their approval of construction from the Maricopa County Environmental Services or ADEQ. But I was very surprised to find this document existed, and because I don't believe it protects the public. It used to be, the board's rules used to be that you could not certify a document until such time as you had verified the construction. And it really required you to have during construction supervision. So I was very surprised when I was informed by an attorney that I could not require the design professional, that they could just go ahead and stamp it. It didn't really matter whether they had ever looked at it, whether it was in the easement or not.
So the statute as presented is broad, and understandably so, because it covers all registered disciplines. So as an architect, Mr. Stanley is a structural engineer, we review record drawings. We may or may not be under contract to do construction observation services. So I want to make sure that whatever we come up with out of this discussion, we have to look at it in two directions. We have to look at something like a civil installation versus a vertical construction. So horizontal versus vertical construction. I think we need to clarify that. I think there is certainly nothing outside of a municipality's purview to say we require the engineers on horizontal construction to observe that construction and then certify it at the end of construction. The statute, subparagraph 1, makes it clear that that's an acceptable practice. The way the statutes, right or wrong, are written, subparagraph 2 is a business decision on the part of the registrant doing that work. Do they want to rely on somebody else's information to include, to be able to certify that installation, or do they want to make sure that they get to see it? And that's a business decision. If we want to prohibit registrants from doing that, it's going to require a statute change at this point, is my opinion.
So what is this, Peter Rizicki again? So let's say an engineer makes a decision to you're certifying the construction, right? So in the past, your certification meant that you're certifying that it was constructed as designed. If you don't know that,
And in other words, the way it was written is that it has to be a bona fide employee, the representative, or the engineer himself that is doing that certification. And what you're saying is, well, make that a business decision. If you don't think that, I guess what you're saying is, we can just certify things based on as-built plans and information that we've obtained, and we just have to trust that that's all accurate, and then we certify. And if there's something goes wrong because of our certification, whose responsibility is it?
Yeah, it's still the registrant's responsibility. I think, like I said, it's the way I'm just going by way the way the statutes are presented right now, right or wrong. that is the case. A registrant could, based on paragraph 2, certify that installation. Mm-hmm. Personally, would I do it? No. I'm not an engineer, but I would not certify anything that I hadn't put my eyes
right.
on.
And I'm sure
right, but we're talking about an issue of public health, safety, and welfare here.
I do not disagree with you at all, sir. This is just a matter of, I'm just telling you, this is what we see in the statute, and I think to move forward from here, we may want to look at revising this statute to somehow make it stronger in the public health, safety, and welfare protection arena.
Or let somebody else certify it, I guess.
I don't know who else.
But that's the problem. That's the problem that the town faces, that what we'll get is that somebody will come in, they'll be paid $200 or $300 to put their seal on a drawing, and then the town, you know, from our standpoint, we have very little recourse other than go out and certify, you know, go out and hire the surveyor ourselves to go and do it. So at this point, we're just saying that until we can accept, until we believe that it's correct, but when I'm trying to get the information from the one who was hired to put their seal on it, they were also the registrant who had designed it. They just came back at the end and put their seal on the as-built so they can get it through the county process, and that doesn't help us to locate and make sure that what we're accepting is correct. And that it's been built that way, and it is a health, safety, and welfare, because we'll get water lines that won't be anywhere near where they were designed. We'll get sewer lines. The sewer line was on somebody else's property. They didn't have the rights to be there. And so the engineer screwed up in the design, but he also then, when they sealed it, and I'm then informed by an attorney, that I can't go after the engineer because of he's protected by number two on that report. That he can go ahead and seal it because he can take the red lines from a contractor and say that that's good enough information.
Well, but it's the engineer's responsibility to review the calculations.
What?
If they're signing and sealing, they take responsibility.
Not according to number two.
Anything I put my seal on, I'm responsible for.
Oh, I agree. I mean, just like Mr. Pisecki, I've sat on the review board for many, many cases, and I recognize that problem. But from this standpoint, this is something that we're dealing with, and I was thinking, well, I'll go to the board. So I called the board about this item and said, well, we really, you know, there's nothing that we can really do about it because the way this is worded, you know, the attorney was correct that we don't have any authority to say what the records were that they used before they put their seal on it.
For number two, that goes entirely against everything that the board has said.
Yeah.
Through the whole history I've been involved in.
Well, I agree.
If you don't do it, you don't stamp it.
Right.
Right?
I agree. But
the lawyer's wrong in that the professional is certifying it. He's still held responsible for it. And couldn't you, as a town, require that they go out and do physical?
We did.
You know, just like a special inspection report.
It took us a year and a half to resolve 160 feet of sewer.
Well, I'm saying from starting from the beginning, like part of your building permit process, is that they have to go out there and certify it with a survey or something like that.
Well,
you could put that as part of your building, like same as the special inspection certificate.
We did from the as-built standpoint, but it did take a year and a half to avoid litigation. But it did take about a year and a half to go through the process. So I do not find this addition that was made to number two seems to be contrary to what the board would require of our professionals.
I agree.
Yeah.
I think what's going to happen is if this. Well, you're right. It's a business decision, but civil engineers and surveyors are in business, right? So if you've got this regulation here, and you decide, now maybe that's not an important thing to the board, but then you've got another engineer that says, oh, no worries, I don't even need to go see the construction. I've got this regulation that allows me to certify it. I'm just going to certify it. And there are a lot of firms doing that right now.
Yeah, they're not going to spend the money.
To the site, because then they've done observation. So then we step on the site, they rely on all this information, then we certify it. They'll review the plans to see if there's anything that doesn't comply, but those plans that are as-built that comes from, say, a surveyor, those just identify the location and elevation, not the design components. So you're creating a situation with this type of process that you're going to have water and sewer systems and potentially other items that are not going to meet the eyes of the design engineer to make sure that it's constructed correctly. And I see that as a problem. When you reference the statute, it is not consistent with that. You're saying that the statute allows this to occur, number two?
I just wanted to bring up, I don't know if the bona fide employee rules and statutes have anything to do with this topic.
I don't think so.
If you put your seal on it, doesn't it require you to have a bona fide employee do it?
That's right.
That's my question.
Yeah. I mean, that's...
Yeah, not according to number two.
Yeah. But number two allows you to step outside of that. So if anything, we should request that number two be striked and revised. I know that
right.
might be not necessarily easy, but I think that should be the recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're in the business, and or let's put it from the owner standpoint, they either have to hire the engineer to go out and do the inspection and do the certification at the end in order to be able to do the certification, or they can just say, I can hire somebody from down the street, here's my red line, stamp it, and be done. You know, that's what number two allows.
Well,
and so that's a business decision, but doesn't seem to make sense.
It doesn't release the guy who seals it from liability. It just just allows the paperwork to go through
Right. Right. And let me. This has just recently happened. I'm doing the civil engineering on a development that has 9 medical office buildings on it. I do the water and sewer. I do some of the inspection. The project goes on hold, and there are other elements that need to be done in order for me to be able to certify. So I tell my client that I'm not going to be able to certify this, and I follow up with him about 2 months later because I haven't heard from him. He says, no worries, we got someone else to do that certification for us. And I can't tell you what's in there. They were supposed to provide photographs. We were supposed to go out there. We didn't. I mean, I hope that they constructed the way I designed it. I just think that it's just we're setting up a really bad practice here, setting us up for a fall.
What I'm hearing is we want to move forward with crafting some new language for this particular provision. And we have to be careful how we do that, because initially what pops into my head is you say, well, the registrant of record who did the design is going, you have to hire them to do the inspections and do the certification at the end. That works great for the horizontal component, but as Mr. Stanley and I know, when it comes to vertical construction, Mr. Stanley will do a structural design. He may not have in his wheelhouse all the special inspectors that have to come along with epoxy bolting and all of this. So we have other people who are reviewing installations and kind of observing the construction and certifying on their own that the epoxy bolts are appropriate, or the high strength bolts, or the torque setting, whatever, all that other good stuff that goes on in the field that's a part of the structure that Mr. Stanley has designed. Those are third-party inspectors that play a key role, and we don't want to write something that's so narrow that we screw that up, for lack of a better way to put it. And I never wanted to imply that paragraph two is a good thing and be flippant about it being a business decision. I'm just saying, as it's written, that's the way it is, and it's bad.
Yeah.
And it needs to be revised. So.
I don't think that the client should be held hostage by having the design engineer, dictate to them, you have to use me and this is what it's going to cost and sorry, but this is the way it is. There ought to be some provision that they can switch gears and get another registrant to do it. I'm fine with that. It's just that this provision, there needs to be a clear direction for the protection of the public.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say maybe there is something that we can crafted in this, that another engineer can do this, but has to be contracted to do that. They need to be into the process of the construction in order to do this. And I don't know whether... I don't have an idea right off the top of my head how that might be put together so that it, doesn't create a situation where a conflict between the owner and the engineer.
Yeah, Peter, it used to be that the requirement for observation during construction was part of the ARS rules regarding the water and sewer construction within the rules. It wasn't a board rule. It was a rule that was built into the water and sewer construction. So that would have that would remove your vertical concern.
Okay.
Like part of the certification requirements by Maricopa County?
It's like Title 9 and Title 18, I believe, are the water and sewer, from the ARS statutes that cover ADEQ's requirements. But they used to be part of that, but they were taken out of that as well as this document was put in. So when they amended their actions, so that really a water line could have a potential for a leak in it, which would potentially, speaking as a town that has not just one water system but two, finding our water lines is a concern, and making sure that they were constructed properly and that they were, we do our inspections as we're going, but as anyone who's involved in that knows, that you don't see everything.
That's very interesting, because if ADEQ did amend their rules, our statute is archaic, and it just demonstrates that it's something we're going to have to obtain a sponsor for the legislature to try to update based on what ADEQ has been doing.
That's one of those cases of a lot of lack of coordination.
Yeah, exactly.
Between what used to be what you professional engineers would rely on the ADEQ statute side of things versus the BTR side of things, and they took something out, but which left a big hole. I think as we move forward and we look at revising this section of the statute, I think we just have to keep in mind that what we're trying to avoid is the registrant sitting behind a desk having a plan come across and go, hey, certify this, and he looks at the drawing and he goes, yeah, it all looks good and the grades look good, and puts his seal on it and certifies it even though he hasn't done the design and he's never actually looked at it in the field, and he's relying on that third party information. That's what we want to avoid.
Right, because
that's exactly what they're doing.
And that's what we want to get, we want to close that loophole.
Right.
So it's not about the same registrant maybe having to do it, but what it might mean is that if another registrant is brought in to do that certification process, the requirement may need to be that they physically observe the construction throughout the course of construction before certifying. So they actually can say, I put my eyes on it. So one of you who designed it may not be doing that, but another registrant would have put their eyes on it, actually seen the installation, documented the slopes and such and the locations properly, and then certified it, because that's the ultimate way we'll be able to protect the public safety.
I think that would be helpful, because what we've done is, as we go in to maintain some of our water and sewer lines, we found that the bedding wasn't done. You know, there wasn't a certification of the bedding being done. So now you have, you know, 6-inch rocks against an 8-inch pipe, and the pipe doesn't last very long. So it's part of the health, safety, and welfare of, you know, having people not cheap out while they're doing the construction.
It's a health item.
If these water lines, and this is Leroy, if these water lines and sewer lines, even though they're initially constructed privately and are going to become part of the city system or municipal system, why isn't that also considered public works? Because on public works, there are no incidentals, but they have to be designed and constructed under the supervision of a registrant.
That's an interesting.
As long as they're not let more than $40,000 for a water line, they can be done. I believe it's $10,000. You don't even need to have a seal. $40,000. You don't. $40,000. In other words, there are numbers within the Maricopa County and ADEQ. Requirements is when you don't need a registrant.
Wow. And yet they become part of the city system, and in the future any changes would be a public works project.
Correct.
Okay.
Well, I'm guessing the definition, we'd have to look at the definition of what constitutes a public works project.
A lot of times what we do is we'll do waterline extensions. Where we will, where the private party that wants to get the service is responsible for extending the line, they'll go through the ATC, AOC process, and we will give we'll approve them on a private side, and then at the end, as soon as the AOC is given, then we'll accept it for operation. You know, we'll accept it into our system for operating, but they paid for the entire construction, and it's not something that we would do as far as use our, our general funds or our funds to design and construct the facility for a private use.
Yeah, I might add that on a lot of commercial and developments, Some of these lines are private. ADEQ actually, not ADEQ, but Maricopa County Environmental Quality require these AOs, approvals to construct and approvals of construction. So they're not just public lines.
I think some of this is just needs to trickle down to the municipal or county level where they can always enact requirements that are stricter than what the board
requires. That's true.
And so I don't want to get into a lot of minutia detail in terms of public works and things like that, because to me it seems like it would be beneficial for Maricopa County if a private water distribution and sewer system is being designed that eventually will be turned over to them, even though technically by definition that's probably not a public works project at the time it's designed. It becomes under the purview of the public and so therefore should be designed to those standards. But I see that as being a local governance issue versus a state governance issue myself.
Well, and I think it could certainly happen faster at the local level than it would with the board going to the legislature and
especially
taking its chances that it will pass in this day and age. So,
but what you are talking about are specifically spelled out in state code. So that we really can't alter, I mean, we could, but it's not something that we typically do, you know, in a town of 6,300 people, that we're going to modify state code for, you know, the number of water lines that we get in a year. Maybe City of Phoenix might, but, you know, or somebody that's putting in, you know, miles and miles and miles, but we're going to rely upon the state code. Or what is allowed and not allowed.
And that's absolutely acceptable. I'm just saying that you can always do something more restrictive than the state. But you
haven't dealt with our council, have you?
No, but we dealt with the legislature.
I'll trade you. I'll give you the Tucson City Council to deal with.
Well, I really appreciate you pointing out another statute that I think we should add to the list that needs to be amended and updated.
So we'll move. We need a motion on that.
So
I'll entertain a motion to revise. Can we get that statute up so we know which one to cite?
Yeah, it's 152.
152. Someone can give me a motion on that, and then I'll need a second. And move that forward.
I move that we request the state board go to the legislature and have 32-152A paragraph 2 revised as discussed.
Thanks, Bob.
This is Foos, I'll second.
Thank you. Any other comments? We have a motion and a second.
Yeah, I'll write this better probably later on as I'm going.
That's fine. Hearing no further discussion, roll call vote, please. In favor.
Leroy Brady.
Aye.
Jason Bruce.
Aye.
Robert Stanley.
Aye.
Edward Marley.
Aye.
Peter Leeds.
Aye.
Motion carried.
Thank you all. Gentlemen, thank you for your input and for bringing this forward to us. This is how we get things back in the right, by having our fellow registrants help us out in this way. So thank you so much.
Yep, really appreciate
it. Again, thank you very much for hearing it.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time and effort in all this. Appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we leave that completely, I'd just like to comment that look at what it's costing the public for some of the stuff the utilities were down in the Queen Creek, Santan areas, what that's costing the public to make corrections and solve problems with. End of story.
Yep. Thank you, Leroy.
Leroy, that's actually really valuable because we move this forward to the legislature. We're going to be looking for examples of where this statute, without these revisions, has come up short in the public interest.
Right.
Agenda, it looks like Do we have Mr. Bruce LaBelle on the line for agenda item 5F?
I am present.
A general discussion about development and whether the board should consider drafting a substantive policy statement regarding their use in a professional practice or an unlicensed practice. So, Mr. LaBelle, if you could state your name for the record and give us your input, please.
My name is Bruce LaBelle. I am a home inspector in the state of Arizona and also an EAC member for the BTR. I was contacted by the BTR just to be a expert in the field and open to discussion on this particular subject, because I'm not sure which direction you were planning on going in with this. The background of information that I sent approximately a week to 2 weeks ago to Kurt was just some of the information that I have acquired over the last couple of years as being the expert for the American Society of Home Inspectors in dealing with drone operations. So I'm here just to help fill in the blanks and answer some questions that may come up in this particular field because of some of the seminars, trainings, classes, and FAA meetings that I've had to attend over the last couple of years.
Okay. I guess I'll open it up to the board first. I have a question, but I'll open it up to the rest of the committee to see if anybody else has questions. Okay, I'll ask mine. So, Mr. LaBelle, my question is, how are drones, because pardon my ignorance, I'm an architect. Some Leroy might say that goes hand in hand with being.
More than Leroy.
How are drones used in the inspection business?
Well, they have several different opportunities to use the drones in the home inspection business, but when Kurt and I had spoken, I guess this is reaching out to land surveyors also, because I guess land surveyors are using the drones to do plotting and geofencing and stuff, so that's where my mindset for this particular conversation was going. But for the question that you asked for, several years ago, in the early adopters for drones, a lot of the home inspectors were utilizing this as a tool to access properties that either they couldn't get onto the roofs because they were deemed unsafe, or because of the type of material, or because of the height or accessibility. And I've been working closely with FAA and writing protocols, working with ASHI, the American Society of Home Inspectors, to come up with different ways and solutions on using this particular, and drone is a slang word. They're actually UAVs, which are unmanned aerial vehicles, is the proper term. But drone is the slang that the commercial world has used for these. And there's set guidelines, and FAA has several different levels of licensings to use these. In certain areas, you can't even fly them because of either municipalities or because of no-fly zones, because of airports. But the whole premise of putting these together were to get into areas that were either deemed unsafe or not accessible, or not accessible safely. So this was just another means or another tool that the home inspection industry was trying to adopt when they couldn't get on a roof with a ladder or with a pole with a camera on it, to give them the information of inspecting chimneys, flashings, roofs, or other areas that were just not accessible. So that's how this all came about. Okay. Several years ago, and how I got dragged into it.
So it's basically, not to be really too basic about it, but it's another tool in the home inspector's toolbox.
Mm-hmm. In the avenue that I was tasked to look at it, yes. But once again, with the conversation that I had with Kurt, they do so much more depending on where you're at. With, you know, they use them in the gas and oil industry, railroad industry, airline industry, because it gives you the ability to get up close and personal without physically having to climb onto something. that you can look at a screen and maneuver this particular aircraft within so many feet of what you're looking at and document imperfections either by still photos or by video. Now with all the software, they have geofencing where if you say, hey, I go out 500 yards north and 300 yards south, there's already geofencing set up by satellite and GPS, which has already been set up and uploaded into a database by land surveyors and engineers. So once again, with the conversation that I had with Kurt, I guess some of the land surveyors or other people are trying to say that, or appraisers or whomever are trying to build themselves as something else outside of their legal licensing by using these drones and the information that they're getting from them. And correct me if I'm wrong, Kurt, but I think that was the premise that we had talked about initially.
It was. It was just some people using drones in a manner that could be a violation of our Practice Act or something of that nature.
Well,
and that's why I sent the information I had, because of some of the legislature that I've gotten to sit through, some of the classes that I was sitting at. Matter of fact, one that was out in the Rio Verde area, I was sitting next to one of the assistant attorney generals for Arizona, and he kept nudging me, hey, what about this, or how do you use this? Because they're trying to write legislature locally where FAA has jurisdiction on over most of it. And some of the topics that came up during some of these classes is, say, for instance, you're at a park, and in the park has a sign saying you cannot fly aircraft while you're in the park. Well, if you're sitting across the street in somebody's driveway, you can fly over the park, and those signs don't apply to you because you're not physically in the park, and the airspace is governed by FAA. So there's some ways of getting around some of that stuff, and that was some of the stuff that I had sent out to you.
There's also use of drones, as all the committee members know, in engineering and surveying practices. Yeah. And I don't know, probably also landscape architecture, right, Leroy?
Yes, and highway-wise, drones are frequently used for surveying and determining quantities and grading and with an accuracy that is hard to get even if you're on the ground.
There's amazing software out there that will do all of that, depending on the type of UAV that you're using to do this. A lot of companies that have had them have called people up and say, hey, can you fly over my dealership because I want to get a picture of everything? Or, hey, I'm looking at my golf course and I'm trying to find out what areas are either overseeded or don't have enough fertilizer or not getting enough water. So they're utilizing those in many different applications, depending on the software package that's incorporated with their system.
So does the committee think we should have a policy statement on the use of a tool?
I'm trying to figure out why we would need a policy statement, because, and Jason, I'm going to ask you to weigh in a little bit here, but give my opinion first. I'm thinking it's just like for the home inspector or for the surveyor or for the engineer, it's another tool in the toolbox. Mm-hmm. It's no different than a GPS system for staking out points on a survey. We don't say we're silent on that in our regulations, I believe, at least on the regulation side of it, or statutes. If somebody wants to use a drone to do topographic mapping, and if it's that accurate, that's awesome. We don't talk about the airplanes that are used to fly orthophoto images for topographic surveys. So I don't see why we would say anything about drones if they're used properly. If a non-registrant uses a drone and does a survey with it, and somebody finds out about it and reports them to the board, it's up to the board to take action against that individual. Mm-hmm. That's my opinion.
Peter Leeds here.
Yeah, Peter.
Mr. Chairman, the question is whether we want to draw up a substantive policy statement or a letter or anything about like that. Last month, or back in March, of course, we decided that the drones were tools, and we don't regulate tools. In the home inspection industry, All the standards require us to do is actually observe describe the we report on the method that we use to observe roofs and structures and things like that. If a person in the home inspection industry is using a drone to look at roofs or anything else around the property, all he has to do to meet our standard is to actually tell us that he's using a drone.
Yeah. How we looked at it and why we looked at it.
So I don't see that we need any rules whatsoever that aren't already written. And I applaud all the gentlemen that are using drones to get to areas that they can't get to otherwise. But other than saying that they did use the drone, I don't see that we need anything else.
I think it's worth monitoring, because if somebody's looking at, if they're using a drone and being sloppy about it, they're not catching things on the roof because they're not getting them close enough or things like that, then I think, the board, having sat there for 6 years, I know that we kind of keep the history of cases in our mind, and we go, boy, we've been seeing a lot of these. Maybe we have a problem. Then we bring this back and look at it. Do we need to say something?
Jason had a
question. Jason, this is Mike Fondren. Can I address some of this from the surveying side?
Sure. Yes, please.
I'll introduce myself since my tag on Google comes up differently. My name is Mike Fondren. I'm a registered land surveyor, state of Arizona. I'm the current chairman of the Arizona Professional Land Surveyors, EAC member, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, and work for a firm that actually uses drones as part of our deliverable and our survey process. Recently, I know Jason knows that we've had a couple of complaints against drones for crossing over into the practice of surveying. From the surveying perspective, we prefer to keep it as a case-by-case basis because, as you guys pointed out, it is a tool. It's used by many different professionals and private people, and it is heavily regulated from the FAA, and if you don't want to get in trouble with them, that was far worse than the board. Surveying doesn't have any interest on regulating drones any more than what we want to regulate scanners or anything in the past with that issue. I don't think that a substantive policy statement is applicable to this because, like you pointed out, it's a tool and it's a very broad-based tool that a lot of people use. So, and we do keep an eye on it on the survey side. And like I said, we have had a couple of complaints this last year that the EAT has reviewed and sent up to the board. So, like I said, speaking for the surveyors, it is definitely a tool that we use, but we don't feel that that's something that should be regulated through the board, other than how its use is at the end.
Mm-hmm. Or if someone's holding themselves out as capable and qualified to do a lawful survey without being registered.
Right, that would fall under what the current board regulations. If you're violating those, that's fine. But you're simply using the tool for anything is not necessary. We recently looked at one that pretty much was a split opinion on whether they were actually doing any survey work, but they were showing boundaries on the internet, so they were crossing that line over. But regulation should be left to the individual, like the use or complaint of the use, not the piece of equipment itself. Because so many people use it. It isn't just surveying.
This is Jason Booth. I'd just like to echo and reflect Mike's words. I mean, that's what the profession believes. And that, our experience has been that we haven't seen any real abrasion with the UAVs yet. And from my personal point of view, it's a tape measure with a propeller. Big deal. So, there you go.
Well said.
The geofencing is just recording some of the information that's already been sent up by the engineers and land savers already, that's saying, hey, we're just verifying that we went out 500 yards and that's where the boundary is. So,
and to your point, that's just controlling the mechanics of the machine. That, I mean, if somebody trespasses with one of these, well, they're subject to trespassing. But you're not applying it's my understanding that the practices or the professions or the users aren't applying hard fixed boundary lines and saying this is the limits of your ownership. They're just defining some kind of envelope to control their machine.
Well, it, so, it should also be pointed out too that the, like for us, for the drones that we use, the onboard software will keep you from trespassing. We're not, it, the drone will stop before it enters a restricted airspace, and that's being when it's being run by, you know, someone that is qualified. All of my survey crews have their 107 licenses. Everyone that operates a drone in this company does, and you're supposed to adhere to those. And the software on the drone protects us from that. It will not fly into areas that are actually restricted airspace. The software simply will not allow it. It'll hit a wall and come back to you. So there's really that type of an issue. The safety issue on that side is not a big deal, because if we do fly in the vicinity of something else, we're required to get permission from, you know, I did a job in Tucson where we were right next to a prison. Even though we weren't going over the prison airspace, those are restricted. We get permission. So anybody practicing correctly doesn't have any of these issues, and anybody not will be in trouble with people that are, that would be worse than being in trouble with the board. So I don't think...
Mike, if I may interject before we lose the thought here, with your fencing that you build in your routine, is that something that's reproducible that you as a, let's say as a respondent, could bring to the board and say, hey, you know, I've been accused of trespassing, here's my file, here's the limit set, this is where we were. Is that something that would benefit registrants?
Well, all the photo centers are identified. There's really nothing different than using a drone for aerial photography. It's standard photogrammetric processing. So all that data is in the computer where it's located at. You know, we have two different types of systems that we use. One is identified by ground control, so we know where that ground control is at, and the photo centers are identified through the processing software. It's the same way any photogrammetric work is done. And then we can actually do airborne GPS located too, where the photo centers are lat long tagged as the aircraft is flying along. So yes, all that information is embedded into the raw data for the in the equipment and could be provided. Now, there are regulations and exemptions that go along with the FAA stuff that have different effects on so-called trespassing and different aspects on the ground, how you get around that. But yeah, that's, Jason, is kind of look at it like when we look at our GPS raw data, how everything's time stamped and location stamped. It's the same thing with the drone.
Sure. And that's the point I wanted to make to the other members, is that by using these tools, we actually have the benefit both as users and both as a regulatory agency, I suppose, at the BTR, to kind of let people express that, hey, I didn't do anything wrong here. Here's my record of what I did, and I did everything right. So I think that's kind of an unintended bonus to this, too. I don't know if that applies to home inspectors so much, but the fact is that all this stuff is recorded now, so it's retraceable and it's documented. And I think anytime we document anything in our processes, that's a benefit to everybody, including the public.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, what I'm hearing is we don't need to take any action here. We just continue to monitor as we have, and if things come up and things look like they're going off the rails, then we'll readdress it.
Yeah, I think it's definitely been a great discussion, and I'm intrigued by how versatile this tool is for various professions. So thank you for bringing it to our attention, Mr. LaBelle.
Yes, thank you, Mr.
Actually, I was called in on this. Somebody else had brought it up before, and I guess somebody remembered speaking with me about some of my experience with it, and I was invited to participate today.
Right.
So I'm here at the will of the pleasure of the board if you need any more information or as we move forward, because I'm still heavily entwined with dealing with this from the national point of view. In dealing with FAA, they keep coming to me to ask me how home inspectors are utilizing this as a tool.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it. I learned a lot today. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And if you want more minutia, I can send more to you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We'll let you know.
Thank you.
Moving along to Agenda item 5A, question from the public. It looks like it came from Mr. John King at AGDOT. Are controlling monuments considered sectional monuments and or created monuments? Wow, Mr. Foose, you're busy today.
Big day for me. Okay, let me start this one off, and I hope I yell all the time, so I hope I don't hurt anybody's feelings or make them think I'm yelling at them, because I'm not. But that's one of the downsides of being on the phone here, too. I think I'm on a CB in a big old Peterbilt or something. So, anyway.
But Jason, we can turn the volume down.
Yes, you can.
Or mute me.
So, I really see a hang-up with Mr. King's question, and part of it is that he introduces his own definitions into his question. And I look at his question, and it is my understanding / opinion that controlling monuments refers to sectional monuments, while other monuments, such as property corners and ADOT right-of-way monuments, are created monuments. I'm not sure what he means by any of these in this whole statement. I know what a sectional monument would be, but controlling and created monuments, I don't find any definitions of those. So I go back to the boundary minimum standards, and in the definitions it says the determination, item C says the determination of the position of any monument, reference point, or any other mark when such monument or mark controls location of boundaries or rights of ownership and real property. So it's not limiting this to section corners. So I don't really see where there's a question here. Now, he did bring up in item 14, which is legal descriptions of the minimum standards, 14E2A, I believe, is the one, and the description shall contain the following attributes: a clearly stated basis of bearings referencing two controlling monuments which were physically existing at the time the property was surveyed. So that's really the only definition that we have of controlling monument here. So with that, I don't see where Mr. King's question really isn't answered by the minimum standard. So I think the answers are all there. I think that he may have adopted some local definitions or personal definitions. And that if he has these somewhere in our statutes or our regulatory guidance or something that he might have from ADOT as well, I'd be more than happy to look at those definitions and address them. But I just don't see where he's arriving at his definitions. I will say this, that again, going back to the local regulatory agencies, municipalities, counties, I'll focus on Mojave County in particular. We do have a specific call in our adopted regulations that say you must tie something to a section corner or a section line or something. And the purpose behind that, I believe, is for indexing for the recorder. I may be a little off on that particular statement, but the fact is that we went through the regulatory process for the adoption of our subdivision regulations, and in those regulations, it calls out something that would be, as Ed said earlier, something more restrictive than the minimum standards.
Mr. Chairman, this is Peter. Peter Leeds, can I interject in here too? I think that Mr. Foose is absolutely right. In all the research that I did here, there's no definition for sectional monuments or the other created monuments that I can find. But I believe that 14, your 14E number 2B is even more appropriate than what Mr. Foote was saying about 14.2A, and saying that all controlling monuments, noting their physical description, whether found or no, I apologize. I'm not talking about that. It's where did I find it? What it was saying was that all controlling monuments, noting their physical description. I read the same one again. Yeah, I know. I got lost in all this paperwork thanks to the drones. But the the one where it said that your controlling monuments will either be, I can't find it, but it's the one that said that whether your controlling monuments are either going to be found or they're going to be restored or they're going to be created. So it seems to me that all your monuments out there would be controlling monuments. And I have no idea what the gentleman was talking about for sectional monuments, although I know there are section monuments, or his other definition of created monuments. It seems to me that would be a controlling monument as well. Peter out, and I'll try to find that clause.
Thank you, Peter. And to kind of clarify that, too, I would add that I can set controlling monuments as part of a survey. The idea, the overarching idea of all of this is to make it so that the legal description is recoverable and retraceable by somebody. So it's immaterial if they're found or set as long as they exist at the time that the retracer is engaged in retracing the survey. So that's the overarching concept here. And I don't see anything in our regulation that would get as detailed or as, I don't know what word I can use, but Mr. King has some kind of predefined or personal definition that I think he's working with, and I don't see that definition.
And Peter Lee is here once again. It seems, I wish Mr. King was here, because I don't know the intent of the question. Whether he feels that he doesn't have to put some of his monuments on his survey or not. I just don't understand why he's asking the question, to be honest.
If I may, Mike Fondren, again. One of the things that we see, and Jason's right, but one of the things we see in the EAC stuff when we're seeing something on a survey is from a purely boundary perspective, monuments are placed on lines between existing monuments related to existing monuments, and you occasionally see a survey where there is one or two found monuments and they set a whole bunch of monuments from that with no reference to any of the surrounding information. So in that instance, controlling monuments would be in basic boundary surveying for properties, we prorate between found original monuments. So you call out and state the original monuments that you prorated between. So they're just not points appearing in space, which would be your created monuments. So everything needs to be referenced. I've seen surveys where monuments on a property were referenced to the center line, but there's no monuments found in any of the instances. They just set stuff out there. So, you know, that's one aspect of it from a purely boundary perspective. The other aspect of it is from, as Jason pointed out, from a county perspective, we have that in Maricopa County, too. Whenever we do a plat that goes through any regulatory review, we're required to tie into two section monuments. The purpose for that is simply so that the assessors can get into the GIS and get a better fit. That's the main thing, and that's the controlling reference from municipalities, you know, when they're talking about tying into a section and a quarter corner. Down here, it's all, you know, the GDAC survey that we're required to tie into, and it's a GIS reasoning for that, too, as well. So those are kind of two separate instances, one from a boundary perspective and one from a record-keeping perspective where there's controlling monuments.
Thank you, Mike. Mike, do you have any thoughts about the question as posed? And let me read the question to you again that's in the packet if you don't have the packet. It says, it would be appreciated if the opinion of the Arizona Board of Technical Registration could be shared with reference to controlling monuments as set out in the minimum standards 14E2A, taking point 3 into consideration as well. So I think he's looking for a definition of controlling. Then he goes on to offer what he thinks the definition might be. But to me, it's pretty clear in the standards. Would you agree with that, Mike?
Yeah, but I'll pick on you here and point out that one flaw in this particular standard is that it is perfectly acceptable to write a description based on record information. I did it when I was in your position there at the county, and we do it too. But if the survey is based on if the record description is being based on a survey, then my opinion would be that the controlling monuments are what control the boundary. So if it's a lot and a block in a subdivision, it might be centerline monuments, it might be block corners. If it's an Alford part or something like that, then the controlling monuments are whatever it takes to get you to break down that portion of the section. I would never say that controlling monuments are only section corners or controlling monuments are only block corners. Controlling monuments are directly relative to the boundary survey that you're working on. Whatever controls that original description, whatever controls that original map, whether it's, you know, block, section, whatever. So I think that, I mean, that's what I would think on it.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And to your point, we've both seen examples of surveys, federal surveys, for example, GLO surveys, maybe BLM surveys, that begin at a NGS point or some kind of USCG point for latitude and longitude, and then they get into their survey work. So it really isn't limited to just section corners or block corners, as you said. It's whatever controlled the survey at the time of the survey.
Right. I think that's a good way to phrase that, Mike.
So don't really need to go anywhere, is that what I'm hearing?
And Mr. King could refer to the discussion that was had at the meeting and also minutes about this once we draft them.
Sounds good. If he needs further clarification, he can send us an email.
That's right.
Any other discussion, gentlemen?
I have none.
All right, hearing none, we'll move along to agenda item 5C. This was brought forward by Mr. John Holmes. Does the expenditure of funds from a general appropriation for the purpose of building renewal create a public works project regardless of scope? And this is an SFB related question, I believe.
He submitted a question after reviewing the previous LNR minutes regarding the roof construction?
Yes, the roofing, re-roofing projects. Basically suggesting that the board ask the AG to provide further clarification to their opinion on this issue.
And we did not hear back.
We never heard back from them.
I mean, I can certainly reach out again and ask, but if you gentlemen remember or want to discuss it further, maybe you could provide clarification, or if not, we can table this to a later agenda.
Well, I think we're being asked to maybe, you know, split some hairs in a way. You know, the statutes basically, well, we just looked at the public works definitions, and it's any project that's run by the state or a political subdivision of the state. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say up to a certain dollar amount or over a certain dollar amount. It just says anything being done by the state is a public works project.
Right.
So if, and I don't think, and so if it requires a design professional input, then it's going to have to be a registered design professional to do that work.
Right.
And I think what they're trying to figure out is, I think they're trying to force us to tell them whether or not they need a registered design professional to do a re-roofing project or a maintenance or something like that.
Yeah,
and I don't know that that's necessarily in the board's purview.
Right, which is why I think we reached out initially to School Facilities Board, which also never returned our calls. So
he includes a copy of the SFB building renewal grant fund definitions. Well, as soon as I see School Facilities Board Building Renewal Grant Fund, I mean, that's state money.
Right. Right, so
if it requires you have design to be expertise, registered. I mean, does it mean that they're going to repaint the walls? No. I mean, it's just, you have to look at it from the perspective of, is the public health, safety, and welfare in jeopardy? If their acts, could their acts lead to a painting the walls and replacing carpet?
Yeah, which clearly no, but a roof maybe needs structural attention.
Structural attention, depending upon where they're going with it.
Right.
And my firm has done a lot of re-roofing projects for the SFB. All over the place. So I think some districts just automatically err on the side of hiring a designer.
Right, which is smart.
Yep. So I don't know, any thoughts from the rest of the committee? Otherwise, I don't know that we have an answer. We can try to get another answer or get an answer out of the AG's office.
We can certainly try again. What do you think, Leroy? You're our resident public works expert.
Well, the question, general appropriation, I mean, I view public works as taxpayer-funded work, but I don't view public works in relation to maintenance. Maintenance is, to some extent, is a renewal, but it is not a change. It is just a repair and a continuous service.
Okay. Yeah, and I agree with you, Leroy, because I'm thinking like an air conditioning unit replacement. If they're replacing it in kind, they can hire a contractor to come out, lift that 5-ton unit off, put another 5-ton unit on, hook it up electrically, and everything's good. Now, where they get in trouble is if the electrical characteristics have changed, if the weight of the unit has changed, then they need to be calling somebody like Mr. Stanley to verify. But they just, it's one of the, we can't get into the minutia management of these kinds of things. We have to rely on, hopefully, there being some smart people in control of the facilities of these buildings. You know, that's a big assumption, but there's only so much we can do.
Yes, and I'd like to point out that to an architect, it may be called minutia; to a landscape architect, it's bushes.
I miss your humor on the board. I'm glad we're together today.
I thought those were called weeds.
Oh, that's what the engineers walk through.
It's called getting in the weeds. And we don't want to do that either. So I think
that's what this question is getting in the weeds.
Yeah, it is.
So I'm thinking we can pose the question back to the AG. If we don't hear anything, it dies.
Okay.
What do you guys think?
I agree.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. 5G, creating a new statute allowing the board to retain jurisdiction over licenses that have expired.
Now, as an update.
I remember this from way back.
Yeah, we actually asked the governor's office if we could write this statute, because we do get requests from individuals who want to retire and put their license in a retired status, which is offered as a statute and a right in other states, but not here. And the governor's office said no, that it would be creating another license status that we didn't need. So we were told, no, we can't do this.
You can't go inactive or emeritus status.
Right, we don't have emeritus. You can go inactive, but it's not the same really as retired.
Right. Yeah.
So even though we tried to explain that to the governor's office, we were told that it was essentially regulatory overreach. So,
and I think they're missing the point there, because to me, it would allow, we could write that in such a way that if the founder of my firm, he's 90 years old.
Oh.
You know, he hasn't practiced since 95. But still ought to be able to be called an architect.
Right, exactly.
You work hard for that.
Exactly.
And it's more about retaining the title
right.
than anything else. So we're not trying to regulate
right.
retired architects and engineers. We're trying to give them the ability, or trying to acknowledge the fact that they invested a lot in their careers, and now they're enjoying the fruits of their labors, mm-hmm. and they still want to be able to call an architect a professional engineer or a landscape architect or whatever, or a certified geologist or whatever they call them.
Yeah.
Well, trained geologist.
Trained, right.
But I think it's more about that than trying to we're not looking to regulate these
right.
individuals.
I agree, but
I don't know how we would sell that.
Well, in 2 years.
In 2 years.
But in 2 years, yeah. we can try again.
And that may be what we do, is mm-hmm. we just have to park this
mm-hmm.
and keep it on the radar, but it's on the back burner until
yep.
2 years from now.
Yep, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So that was just more of an update for okay. you to know we haven't forgotten it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think it wasn't it also tied to the possibility, I'm thinking of someone is about to be, you know, sent down the river, and they just, and so rather than go through an adjudication process, they just bail out of their license.
Yeah, I think that was part of it.
And I think that's part of it. And that maybe what we have to do is bifurcate that out.
Right.
And make that a separate issue, allow us to do an emeritus status mm-hmm. on a license, and then... Because maybe the governor's office, maybe that's what they were, you know, they were seeing overreach because, oh, all of a sudden you want to put the hammer down on this individual.
Yeah.
But they've relinquished their license.
Right.
And so
we explained that we're not charging. We wouldn't charge for someone to go into emeritus
yeah.
status, but
it's,
they
it's
still...
It's a checkbox on a,
right.
on a website that says you're in emeritus.
Right.
And that's it. And then you don't charge them to... keep their license anymore, but the statute should be written in a way that allows them to retain the use of the title.
Just, right.
You know.
Yeah.
And if they and put it in a requirement that they're going to seal something, then they need to contact the board to reactivate their
mm-hmm.
license. Seems really fair. So.
Yep. Well.
Yeah. We'll keep.
We'll
it.
Try again.
We'll try again
years.
At some point in 2 years.
I think we skipped E.
Oh, did we skip E? I crossed it off. Oh. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, I skipped it on purpose, I think.
Maybe.
Okay, how can a firm have a principal... Okay, agenda item 5E. How can a firm have a principal that is not an employee of the firm? Does the principal of the firm, as defined in ARS 32-141A, need to be an owner of the firm in order to directly supervise bona fide employees as defined under R430-101-3, or... can a contracted employee slash registrant be a principal of a firm?
So this was just under future agenda items from the last meeting,
yeah.
so I just moved it forward
okay.
to this meeting.
And this may be something that you as the registrants understand better than staff, who is kind of confused about the difference between a principal of a firm and who is or should be a bona fide employee. So maybe separate
yeah, so,
issues.
I don't want to do all the talking here, but you know, I think in the last set of minutes or in the last meeting, I brought up the fact that international firms could have a local office.
Mm-hmm.
They could have someone managing that office. They may or may not be principal in that firm. They may not be an owner.
Mm.
So they may be the manager of that branch, but let's take somebody like Gensler or SOM. So SOM is probably better just because I happen to actually know that they are a publicly traded company. They are on the New York Stock Exchange. They're that big of a firm. I could be an owner in SOM if I wanted to buy some of their stock. Do I want to be in responsible charge of their Phoenix office? No.
Yeah.
So I think we have to look at, we should probably look at the statute and see how it defines firm ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to look at and then we need to look at kind of, what's the other term we're looking for here? Direct supervised and bona fide employees.
Do we have a definition of what a principal is by the state board? Because principals mean everything. I mean, you've got five different firms, you're going to have five different definitions.
Yep, exactly. I have eight principals in a firm of 21 because I've got eight stockholders. We're a privately held company, but we have eight stockholders. But I have other registrants in my firm who oversee the work of other people. So I think we have to... Right now on our firm card, if you look at it, we have one principal who signs the firm registration, and their name's the only one that's on it, even though we have eight of us. And those, all eight of us are supervising everybody else, including other registrants, and we're the ones that are sealing those documents that are going out. So, I guess we kind of fit the definition pretty well because we have principals, and we're supervising bona fide employees.
Right.
But does a principal of a firm as defined need to be an owner of that firm in order to directly supervise those bona fide employees? I guess.
Don't know if it needs to be an owner, but it certainly shouldn't be a contract employee.
Should not be a contract employee. In fact, I think contract employees are very, since I'm the money guy in my firm, I know a little too much about IRS regulations and definitions of contract employees, and quite honestly, there's like 24 criteria that a contract employee has to meet in order to be qualified as a contract employee, and that sets up a real stumbling block because one of them is they take no direct direction from the contract employer. So now how do you resolve direct supervision with no direct direction from the supervisor? And I think our colleagues put themselves maybe in a hot spot, more of a hot spot with the IRS than they would with the board, because they are going to give them red lines, they're going to do all it. And now we got the whole issue of what constitutes direct supervision, because we have firms that are sending red lines to China and India, getting them drafted overnight and sending them back for review. Or they're doing it, they have an office in Minneapolis that's doing the project and they're sending stuff. They've got a drafter here in Phoenix who's working on their Revit model on their server in Minneapolis. Directly supervised. Kind of a big question. We have to. I think we almost have to look at what that all means. And I know at NCARB, Bob Calvani, the president, has stood up a task force or something to study this whole responsible charge issue because it's evolving in our profession. I'm reviewing drawings when I'm sitting in a hotel room in New York that my folks have done in Tucson, but that's how I have to practice.
Right.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
So I feel like I'm in responsible charge because I'm still reviewing their work, even though we're remotely located for a time. So.
But that I think qualifies as direct supervision because you're looking at their work.
Right.
And either they're a contract employee or a bona fide employee, you're still reviewing that work and taking responsibility.
Right. But I think the statutes, when they were written, what comes into my head is the architect mentor peering over the shoulder of the drafter who's drawing the lines on the paper. I mean, that's how old some of this language is. And so, is it broken? I don't think so.
Okay.
But do we need to, sometime down the road, do we want to revisit this and maybe make it more contemporaneous with how we practice today? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you guys think, Bob, Jason, Peter?
I think it does need some research and some qualifications and stuff in there, because there's so many things that mean different things to different people.
Right.
You know, right here in the Arizona, forget about outside of Arizona.
Yeah.
Peter here, I think we really need to define principal.
Yes.
It seems like principal is the one term in the whole definition that it has ambiguous meanings.
I, would agree.
Yes. Peter?
Yes. Yeah, this is Doug Carlin. There actually is a principal definition in the statute under 32101, number 28. I mean, it's pretty loose, but it is there.
Well, do we need to revisit that? And again, we have to look at it in terms of the context of today's way that firms are structured and are practicing. I think back when a lot of these were crafted, all the firms were local.
Right. Yep.
If you had two offices, you had a partner that worked in one in Tucson and one in Phoenix, mm-hmm. and everybody kind of oversaw that work.
Yep.
And now with international practice.
Yep. I think Ed and Bob Stanley and maybe Leroy will remember, we were holding architects who were like managers of branch offices responsible for failing to pay in time and all the rest, even though they didn't have any say or control over the pocketbook.
Yeah, I think at that time I pointed out that, yes, by the letter of the law, they are responsible, but that's a problem.
Right. Right.
We need to, I think, at some point we need to revisit that whole scenario because it's not fair to ding the guy who doesn't sign checks. I sign checks. If I don't pay my consultant in time, I'm the one that should get in trouble.
Right.
But the problem is you'd go after my partner, Phil, who may not know that we haven't paid consultants. We have a great working relationship. He would know, trust me. But... But, you know, not all firms operate at that same level. And so I technically should be the one that gets in trouble, but because I sign the checks. But, somebody that works for Gensler who is a manager here, they don't even have a checkbook in that office.
Doug Perlman, thank you for that. Now, it says in the principle, it means an individual officer of a corporation or is designated by a firm as having full authority. I mean, that's a perfect definition.
Yeah.
So it begs the question, why are we confused on this now? It seems to me that any firm can designate anyone who's a principal, designate anyone as a principal, and then that our rules say that principal then needs to be a registrant as well. So I don't see why we're questioning this definition anymore.
I think you're right. Thank you. Thanks for bringing that up, Doug. That really helps clarify it because I have, like, again, go back to my firm, we have 8 principals, but only 3 of those principals are officers in the corporation.
And the definition, they can be designated by the firm, they don't have to be an officer in the corporation. Right. It says officer in the corporation or designated by the firm.
So basically, from a responsible charge standpoint, the other 5 partners in our firm, or principals, they're designated to have that full authority to oversee work.
Okay, so the question comes, can you have a contract employee be a principal? By definition of IRS, you can't, but this doesn't exclude that.
It really doesn't.
Because you get that a lot. You get somebody who's basically a CAD operator, needs to get something sealed, so he hires a guy to review his drawings, which is not cool, but, or he hires some guy on a contract basis to oversee it so he can get it sealed.
Well, I think
we used to run into that often.
I think the key there is they would have to, even though he's a contract guy, that drafter would have to file a firm card with that other, with the contract employee's name on it, stating that they are the principal in charge of the firm. And I think they typically get in trouble for not having that in place. Because they're practicing as an architectural firm, hiring this hired stamp, and they don't properly register that firm with the board, and that's where they get hit.
Yep.
Well, but then also, if in order to be able to seal it, they have to be a bona fide employee, which is there a definition there?
Yeah.
There is.
Okay.
and then they have to be able to have supervision authority over there, the one to make the final decision on the optics, not the guy that owns the firm. Right? The guy that owns the firm says, you know, I don't want to put a door here, but by fire code we have to. The owner doesn't want the door here, but by fire code we have to put it there, so I'm telling you, I'm not going to put it there, type of thing.
Mm-hmm. See, I think when they start to get tripped up, those ones that do the hired stamp, they get tripped up by 3101-3CIII. Receives direct wages from the project prime professional who has a contract with another registrant, and the work product is the responsibility of the latter registrant. Well, maybe not. Sorry, I spoke too soon. That's like for consultants. See, but actually, C does cover it because it receives direct wages from the registrant, receives contract compensation from the registrant, or direct wages from the project prime professional. I mean, it's how the money flows. The money needs to always flow through the registrant to the person doing the drawings, not the other way around. And that's how we used to, and that's how, when I was on the board, that's how we interpreted whether there was a, determine whether it was a violation or not. Did the money flow the right way? And if the money flew through a non-registrant to a registrant, we found that to be troublesome.
Right.
If it flew through the, if it flowed through the registrant to the non-registrant, then everything
was okay.
Okay, unless there were firm registration issues involved.
So. Kurt, I can't read that rule. It's foggy on my computer.
So I think this bears some further discussion. I think we need to refine this section and clarify so that we bring some clarity to it. Because again, it's written under older times.
Yep.
And
I think we need to
make it again more contemporaneous to today's practice.
Okay.
Any other comments?
Peter, I don't believe we need to do anything. When we're talking about 5E on our agenda, it says a question from the public: how does a firm have a principal that is not an employee of the firm? Well, it can't. And or does the principal of a firm as defined under ARS need to be an owner of that firm in order to directly supervise? No. The answer is no.
Right.
And can a contracted employee resident be a principal of the firm? I believe the answer is yes. And I think that between all these definitions and the rules, that this specifically spells all that out. And then, of course, if there's a question about it, the board can handle it under a complaint situation and
I think what I'm alluding to is there's some glitches in this in terms of who's held responsible for the acts of the larger corporation.
Yeah.
I think in fairness to our registrants, that bears some scrutiny at some point, not today.
We will add it to the list of things to rewrite when we can.
Sounds good.
In 2 years.
Yeah.
In 2 years. Put it on the 2-year agenda.
Assuming.
Agenda item 5-8, possible election of an L&R chairman.
We put this on just because we've had it almost a year and a half between meetings, and yeah. I mean, you don't have to elect a new chairman if Ed is willing to continue to serve as such, but we thought we'd put it out there to see what you all think.
I'm willing, unless there's somebody who really feels like they want to take it on.
Cool.
That was the only question I had, if you were willing.
I am.
Okay.
I'd be all in. This is Peter. I'd be all in favor of Ed if you would burn his volume a little bit.
What?
I know. There you are. Thank you.
So moved.
Okay, we're reaffirming it. Excellent. Right.
Thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate it very much. Future agenda items, I think we've kind of listed through those.
Yep.
Future meetings, do we need to try to schedule something?
That's up to you. We can wait, or we can try to schedule like within the first 6 months of 2021.
Why don't we just wait? It's so hard to hurt all the cats that...
You're right.
I didn't know if we needed to follow up before, like in January or something, for anything that we might drop.
Yeah, we're not running any legislation. We are anticipating that the Institute for Justice will revisit the rewrite of the definition of engineer and engineering practice. But we haven't seen any language. We haven't been invited to any meetings with legislators about that. We could just wait and see what drops. And if we need to call you, we will.
You can talk us then. Sounds good.
Okay.
Let's do it that way.
Okay.
I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
Move to adjourn.
All right.
Thank you all for chatting with us today. It was great.
It's been great.
Happy holidays.
Oh, thank you.
Forward to seeing everybody in person.
Don't eat too much turkey.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, guys.